When I was young, I looked up to some women who I thought were very godly and very submissive. In retrospect, I can see that they were only weak and afraid human beings.
This is Christianity at Work from McKenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon. On today's program, Dr. Jack Crabtree and family therapist Christine Barber focus their discussion on the biblical concepts of headship and submission. Few topics incite more debate and argument among Christians. There are numerous reasons for this, including both misunderstanding and abuse. Today, Jack and Christine try to unpack the biblical definitions at the heart of this controversy. Let's listen.
We're going to devote the next couple of weeks to submission and headship. So, Jack, what is submission and what is headship according to the Bible?
It's interesting that you mention them together because I think they are correlated concepts. You can't really understand submission of a wife to a husband without understanding headship. I think headship, from a biblical perspective, is the greater and is the greater responsibility that a husband has before God for the relationship, for the partnership of marriage that a husband and wife are in. Submission really is nothing more and nothing less than the wife acknowledging that greater responsibility that the husband has. There's certain implications of that, but I think fundamentally that's all submission is. The wife is appreciating that the husband has to stand before God about what they, as a partnership, do.
So what you're saying is that God has given the man greater responsibility.
And I think so.
We need to define that
yeah.
in just a minute here. And the woman is acknowledging that greater responsibility by submitting to it.
Right.
Okay.
By submitting to it, and we have a lot more that we're going to have to say about that because that could easily be misunderstood. I think I would use the word by appreciating and acknowledging that that's the case, that the man has a responsibility to follow his conscience before God because he's the one that is going to bear the greater responsibility.
What do you mean by he bears the greater responsibility? How does that really look in real life?
Okay. I wish I had a better answer to that. I think of in James, James says, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that as such you will receive a greater judgment, I believe is the word. And what he seems to be suggesting there is that in a teacher-student relationship, a teacher who is presuming to lead someone else into wisdom and to spiritual truth is going to bear a kind of responsibility for leading someone astray that is going to bear some of the responsibility for the error that the student might deviate into. Does that mean that the student is not individually and personally responsible for their choices and their being attracted to error and falsehood and so on? I don't think so. I shouldn't think that's what James means. But James is recognizing that because of the nature of the relationship that they have, some of the error of the student kind of rests on the shoulders of the teacher.
To make that, I'm sure that teachers listening can relate to that and think, boy, that really makes a lot of sense to me. As you're talking, I'm thinking about that in our role here as we're talking on the radio. We're bearing a responsibility for what we say.
Right.
But I'm trying to think, how do I make that even more common? How do I help people understand that? And I think possibly it could fit into our role as parents, that we have a greater responsibility than our children for headship
yeah,
in that sense.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Now, if you ask, what does that translate into in practical terms? Are there more whippings at the judgment seat? Are there more rewards? That the Bible is not clear about. You know, exactly what this greater responsibility translates into in the final analysis. I don't know the answer to that. Parenting is a good example. Intuitively, we recognize that my children are not on their own. I must presume to guide them and direct them, and I bear responsibility for the degree to which I lead them and direct them. But this could be misunderstood. I'm not suggesting that the husband-wife relationship is analogous to the parent-child relationship. The marriage relationship are two equally responsible adults in a partnership together. It's not that the husband is to train the wife or to teach the wife or even to be a priest of the wife, as is a kind of a common notion that you hear out there. I think that's a huge mistake. They are to forge a partnership together as one flesh. And the problem is, in doing that, you can't live two independent lives. So whose conscience is going to bear on decisions that they have to make in common if their consciences don't agree, if they come to an impasse?
Could you give
and
me an
that's
example?
That's where I think headship comes in.
So can you give me an example of that, where two consciences don't agree?
Let's say that you take an issue. We live in a particular world, a particular society with particular social pressures on it, and a young couple are trying to decide, how are we going to educate our children? Are we going to homeschool them? Are we going to stick them in a Christian school or a private school or send them to the public school? With all the pros and cons of all those different choices, which choice are we going to make? Well, that kind of choice has really two aspects to it. On the one hand, there's a moral component to that choice. I want to do right by my children, and I want to be responsible in putting them in an environment where their education is going to honor God, is going to teach them to seek to know God and love God, teach them the things that a human being needs to learn, on the one hand. And it would be wrong of me, it would be morally remiss of me to not take that into account and want the spiritual training of my children. So that's a moral component. I really don't have an option about that. I have a moral obligation to do what is most spiritually beneficial to them. On the other hand, there's another component to that decision, and that is a judgment call of the facts of the case. What is going to be the effect of putting them in public school? What is going to be the effect of putting them in a secular private school? What is going to be the effect of putting them in the Christian school? And in a sense, my guess is as good as yours, or the husband's guess is as good as the wife's guess. That is a really difficult issue, and the truth of the matter is very debatable. So
you're saying that there's spiritual growth, generally speaking, it's really my responsibility as a parent.
Right.
But where that takes place best is the decision we need to make.
Exactly. And it would be very understandable, therefore, in that case, that the husband and wife might disagree on the second aspect of that decision, the facts of the case. One person may feel very, very strongly that it would be most beneficial to put them in a Christian school, whereas the other partner may decide that, you know, I really don't think that would be the best place to put them for whatever reasons, and homeschooling them perhaps, or public school, or another private school, maybe is going to be in the end the better place for our children. And they may both feel convinced of their judgments in that regard, and therefore you bring in the moral component, we need to do right by our kids, and you really have two peoples who in good conscience disagree about what the morally right thing to do with respect to their kids is. Well, if they feel strongly and if they are feel conscience-bound to make their particular choice, how are they going to be one? How are they going to make a unified decision in common about how to educate their children when each of them feels conscience-bound to do the opposite of what their partner thinks they should do? Whose conscience do they follow? And it seems to me that headship is the concept, the institution that God had devised, the arrangement is probably a better word, the arrangement that God has devised in marriage to give one of them the freedom to actually violate their conscience without being unrighteous.
And that is the wife, and she then gives the decision to her husband, even though she feels very strongly.
Yes. Now, gives the decision to her husband, but I think it would be a mistake to see her as giving it to him passively. That is to say, nothing about the concept of headship, as I understand it, would suggest that she be silent. Her first impulse would be and should be to seek to persuade her husband of her point of view. Here's what I'm seeing, here's how I'm perceiving the situation, here's why I think this is the best way to go. Please agree with me, you know, don't take this as I really think this is the right thing to do. That would be perfectly appropriate and not at all inconsistent with her appreciating and respecting the role the husband has.
Okay, her responsibility, you're saying, would be to persuade her husband. I think you might also say that it is his responsibility to persuade her, and for them to then be in this mutual dialogue of both trying to persuade,
yes,
and
absolutely,
to be willing, I think also underline this, to be persuaded.
Yes.
So both of them are in a dialogue that's ongoing and that's open to each other's insights and appreciating them and working with them. And my guess is in this kind of a situation, it wouldn't be a dialogue. It would be a dialogue over perhaps even many years,
yeah,
where it's not that when the husband decides, then the law is laid down, but that he continues to be open to new information, as does she, and they continue to work with that.
Yeah, because their goal should always be oneness of mind. That's part of, we've talked about this in the past, that's part of the very promise that we make to each other in marriage, to become one flesh with one another, is that we're going to really seek to have our minds meet and to become one in the way we look at life and perceive life. That's an ideal, however, and we don't always achieve that, but we should always strive for that. So I think you're absolutely right, that we never stop the dialogue just because, practically speaking, we have to make a decision today. We can always revisit that and continue talking about it and conversing and seeking to understand one another and our perspective.
We'll return to Jack and Christine in a few moments. Do you want your son or daughter, or maybe yourself, to get a good college education? Be sure to ask this question. What is college for? Is it a rite of passage to adulthood? A ticket to a good career? What is it for? A Gutenberg college education is the first step to pursuing a good life. Then the question, what is a good life, is appropriate. At Gutenberg, a good life begins with the pursuit of wisdom rather than mere knowledge. The student's character is as important as his intellectual growth. Now, we readily admit that Gutenberg isn't for everyone. But if you are interested in reading and discussing the greatest thinkers, philosophers, poets, and theologians of Western civilization, if you are interested in working personally with your teachers in small discussion-oriented classes, and if you want to begin those crucial steps to a good life, consider Gutenberg College. Now, let's return to our discussion regarding biblical headship and submission.
So in my experience as a counselor, I've often seen husbands say, I made the decision, you need to submit to it. It's just done. And in one sense, she has the opportunity to do that. She can just say, I'll stop. But in another sense, perhaps she needs, it's her responsibility to say, well, there's some more issues out here, and beseech her husband to continue to dialogue with her.
Right. Yeah, there is that is using the concept of submission just to mask what is basically fundamentally evil. There is nothing loving, there is nothing respectful, there is nothing honoring of my wife to just say, submit to me. You know, I've made the decision, submit. That's evil. It's unloving. It is totally unbecoming of a husband to
now
do
that. That's a big word. Why are you saying that it's evil?
It's a part of our innate tendency to want to be the center of the universe. It's a part of our innate tendency to want other people to serve us and honor us rather than serve and honor them. And that's at the heart of what human evil is all about.
Okay, so I'll be the husband for a moment and say, okay, but I'm the head and I have the responsibility before God to say the way it's going, to make that decision and stand on it.
Okay. I think this biblical concept, what it's saying to you, though, is yes, you are the head, but what that means is you're going to be accountable for God for this decision. Are you going to be so arrogant and so presumptuous as to say the partner that God gave you has no wisdom to share with you about what decisions you should make, so that when you do stand before God, you can receive praise and not condemnation, not censure?
Ooh, that's big. You're saying that I, as the husband, have a big responsibility, and part of my responsibility is to include my wife in my decision making.
Absolutely. We'd be crazy not to, as husbands. You know, unless we are completely convinced that all wisdom ends with me and I know everything there is to know, in which case I have a huge problem to start with.
That's pretty scary.
Yeah. Unless I'm prepared to say that, then I, not only should I listen to my wife, but I should listen to the counsel of other people, but most especially the one that I've promised to become one flesh with. She should be my first counselor. Not only because, just as another person with another perspective and another experience with God, she may have wisdom that I lack, but furthermore, I need to understand where she's coming from anyway and what she's seeing and what she's experiencing anyway, because that's part of what it means to become one flesh.
And Jack, in making these decisions is the very place where we become one flesh.
Precisely, yeah.
And if I just pull headship, and in the sense of being an authoritarian that's laying down the law and not listening, then what I'm doing is I'm violating my commitment, my promise toward oneness.
Right.
And I want to turn the tables also. I think it's true with women. If I, as a woman, just say, I'll just go along with my husband without dialogue, without discussion, without thinking about it, without bringing in my perspective, then I too am violating my commitment to oneness, because I'm not using the very tool, the very context that God is giving me to develop that oneness between He and I. I'm simply giving up rather than sharing with and working with.
Exactly. And the mistake that we make is that we often take that kind of fearful, timid passivity where a woman is not submitting to her husband but is actually copying out of the relationship. We often hold that up as a kind of virtue. Here's the really model submissive wife. That's not the case, I don't think. I think the submission that is a part of this concept of headship and submission in the Bible is something that a woman does out of a strength of character, not out of a passivity of giving up and trying to not make waves.
What kind of strength of character is that? Could you describe that kind of woman?
Well, it includes the human strength of recognizing what God has given me to do in life and where He has put me in life. And so in the case of a woman, to recognize God has put me in relationship to this husband to be what Genesis calls his helper. That's the role He has given me to do. It's not a position of inferiority. It's just simply what He has given me to do. And I must do that with wisdom, with courage, with faith and trust in God, with a commitment to truth and right, righteousness and goodness and justice and so on. My strength comes from just my individual core character out of which I'm acting. Now, it may be that my role to the husband requires me then to say, I don't agree with you, but you are not persuaded. Go ahead, I will back you in this decision. I mean, I will cooperate in this decision that you've decided we must make. Before God, I think this is a mistake, mm-hmm. I think this is wrong, but my job is to help you, and so I will.
You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking that this could be difficult for women in two very different ways. For some women, it will be very difficult to say anything in their role as a helper. That they will, out of fear, basically that's the core of it, and out of not having developed this strength of character, give in to their husband in order just not to have to engage in life in an active way. And again, I think that is such a violation of our commitment that we're supposed to make to become one. It's also a violation of my commitment to become a full functioning person.
Right.
And which is equally as important. and I cannot really be, I think what you're saying, in this helping position without being a fully functioning person that has definitely looked at what they think, what they feel, who they are, looked at what they value, committed themselves to becoming a wise person. They can't do that.
Right.
But at any hand, there's this one side where women will have a hard time speaking up and joining in the process of oneness. On the other hand, I can imagine that there are other women, can't just imagine, I can imagine myself being this way, who would have a much more difficult time after much discussion, after having entered into it quite a lot, to then say, okay, I'll give you the opportunity to make that decision, as in the case of the educational decision that you were, example that you were bringing up before. It would be more difficult for this person to say, okay, they have dialogued. And so there's a whole continuum of difficulty. It isn't that if I give in, I'm a godly woman, or if I don't give in, I'm a godly woman. We have to look at the context of the whole situation.
Right, yeah. With respect to the latter one, the strength that we need to develop is to have the virtue of what the Greeks called sophrosune. The pagans held that as a virtue. It's clearly a virtue in New Testament writings. Sophrosune is hard to define, but it's basically knowing and accepting the boundaries that God has placed on my life. Recognizing that I can't just create myself and have the freedom to make myself whatever I want to be. I don't have the authority over my own existence to do that. It's God who's my creator, and he's the one who's put me in this life to play the role that he wants me to play. And as a human being, I have two options. I can either pound against the barriers on my life and make my fist bloody out of spite that I have those boundaries on me, or I can accept that I am a creature and live within those boundaries and be content and be satisfied and be delighted to just live excellently in the role that God has given me to do. That virtue is not something that comes naturally to us. And I think that's what's required for a woman to really come to terms with this role that God has given her in marriage, is to develop the virtue of sophrosune.
To be willing to accept the limits of myself as a creature.
Right.
I just came from talking to somebody just a few moments ago and just was weeping with them in their recognition that they were a creature, that they've spent their life trying to be the creator, trying to be the person who's in charge. And I think what you're talking about, Jack, is a profoundly, profoundly difficult lesson. It is probably the most difficult one because it meets us at the very core of our soul, where we want to raise up and say, I'm in charge. And to give that up, to open our hands to that, is incredibly difficult. In fact, it's like God has to put us in a place where we can't climb over, and we can't, like a dog, dig under the fence. He's got to put us up against the wall and teach us that. And that's a profoundly difficult thing to learn. And I think perhaps that's what a lot of women must learn in their relationship, in their marriage relationship, is at some point, I have to be willing to humble myself.
Right. I think it's important in the debate that is going on currently about whether headship is even a viable concept in this day and age. There are a lot of people who argue, well, that was okay for the first century, but you know, we're way beyond that now. I think that's wrong. I think that misunderstands what the Bible is teaching. I think that's a tragic mistake on the one hand. But I do think it's important to recognize that in something like 1 Timothy 2, where Paul is saying, I do not permit a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, and so on, a very emotionally charged and controversial passage. What Paul is concerned about in that passage, though, primarily, is not whether or not women teach. What he's concerned about is whether or not women have the virtue of sophrosune. That word occurs, I think, twice in that passage, the Greek word sophrosune. I think that's his primary concern. His primary concern is, are you the kind of person, you women, in Ephesus. Are you the kind of women who are willing before God to let God rule your lives? Are you the kind of women who are willing to live within the boundaries that the Creator Himself has put on you? Through whatever means. Sometimes the boundaries that God puts on us are through society and culture. Not, sometimes it's through biology. Sometimes it's, and therefore through nature. Sometimes it's through the particular relationship with my particular husband. Many things impinge on my life to create boundaries that really I'm not going to be able to break out of righteously. Am I willing to live with that? Because God ultimately is the author of all of those forces that are creating the boundaries. He would say the same thing to men. In 1 Timothy 2, he just happens to be dealing with the issue of women who are not exercising sophrosune with respect to this teaching role that they want. But Paul would say that to every human being in any circumstances that they're in. My concern is, regardless of what's objectively right and wrong here, are you willing to submit to the boundaries that God has in fact placed on your life and be content with that? If not, there's a fundamental spiritual problem that has to be dealt with.
So what you're saying is that the role that we as men and women both have is to be willing to submit ourselves to the boundaries that God's placed on us. Instead of being people who are clenched fist, tight jawed, holding up against what God wants us to do, we're people who are willing to loosen our hands and hold them out and accept whatever God has for us.
It's well said. Exactly. Yeah.
In the past, Jack, when you and I have talked about submission and headship, you've talked about servanthood and slavery, and use those as a good, I think, description or good picture of submission. Can you talk about that some?
Okay. There's a false view of headship that I'm sure is out there. I'm not sure I see it as often as it is alleged to be out there. I imagine you see it more often than I do. But there's a false view of headship that seems to view the man as having the authority to be a little tin god in his relationship. That as the head, it's you, my wife, have the responsibility to serve me, to meet my needs, to do my will, to do my every bidding. So, you know, I sit on the couch and my wife is supposed to pop grapes in my mouth while I watch a football game or something like that, and she's supposed to wait on me and be my servant. It's as if I were the master and my wife is the slave. That's sort of the model. Well, that couldn't be further from the truth. It seems to me that the headship model implies rather that if I am the husband in the relationship, I am the first servant. I am the one who will be first to serve, because it's my responsibility to keep our relationship healthy. If anyone needs to, this is going to sound strange, I'll have to explain it, but if anyone is going to submit, it ought to be me, not my wife. If anyone is going to concede, it ought to be me, not my wife. If anyone is going to say I'm sorry and ask for forgiveness, it's going to be me first and not my wife. That is, my expectation should be, since I have a greater accountability for this relationship, it's most important that I be the first to take initiative and step in and do what is necessary to be reconciled, to restore the relationship, to make sure the relationship is healthy. And whatever that takes, I need to take initiative and take primary responsibility to make sure that it happens for my part. Instead, we've inverted that. We've perverted that to make it so that since I'm the head, I don't have to take initiative toward making this relationship healthy. That's your job, wife. Shape up, you know, do things right and make this go for us. Well, that's exactly backwards. I think that's completely wrong.
What comes to mind for me is a situation I was in when I was in high school. I had a friend whose parents were Christian leaders, and the idea that I got about headship and submission in the very beginning as a Christian was from them. And he literally used to snap his fingers at his wife, and what she would do is go and say, okay, oh dear, what would you like? And he would be sitting at the TV switching channels, channel surfing, and say, Coke, Coke. And and she'd run and go get us Coke, and she'd put it on the table, and then he'd say, pour it. And then she'd have to pour it in a particular way. And then it was amazing to me. Then he would say something like, dinner. I would like it right here. And she would go rush around and do it. He would pay no attention to the children. He would pay no attention to anybody else's needs but his own. If anybody else sat down and watched TV, he was completely inconsiderate and perhaps even unaware that they existed, and would continue to look at the shows that he wanted to as he was reading the newspaper at the same time, shutting his family out. And so that, for me as a high schooler, was a very, very bad and probably, I hope, severely wrong way of presenting headship and submission. But that's how they talked to me about it, that this was the appropriate role for them.
Wow.
That was a horrible way to come into learning this, and it's exactly what you're talking about. At the extreme, he was a 10 god, and she was an afraid, almost non-person.
Well, I hope I'm not being inconsiderate to say that that's sick. I mean, there's absolutely nothing about that picture that matches what I understand to be the concept of headship and submission in the Bible. Quite the opposite. I mean, that's why Paul says in Ephesians 5, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. I mean, that's the model that he gives for what headship should mean in terms of how a husband relates to his wife. He doesn't say, husbands, make sure that your wives serve you adequately. He says, serve them, love them in the way that Christ loved the church. And how did he love the church? He actually was willing to give his life itself for their well-being. That's the model, that's the paradigm for what it means for me to be head of my wife, is to give my life for her.
I think about Jesus washing their feet, and yet
right.
He was the head. He was the leader.
Right.
And that's the way in which he was. He also told the truth. He was very clear about having people look at reality and try and face into what was real and true.
Exactly.
So he wasn't a wimp servant, and I think very often when we think about servanthood, we think about people being wimps.
I think the reason for that, of course, is just our innate human tendency to associate glory and honor with power and control. In general, Jesus was teaching the disciples, don't be like the Gentiles who lorded over, don't be like the Gentile, you know, rulers who lorded over their subjects. But, no, I can't remember what it says, but basically be like me, be a servant.
Mm-hmm.
And that, we just have a completely backward concept of nobility and what it means to be honorable and a glorious person. If we had eyes to see, we would recognize the beauty and the nobility and the awesomeness of servanthood. But instead, because of our evil and the evil eyes that we look at life through, we're really attracted to people who are powerful. In fact, we even go to movies and applaud people who are arbitrary and capricious in their use of power, can be cruel in their use of power, and sometimes we respond positively to that. That's terrible. That's atrocious. That's as perverse as you can get. And yet, somehow we think, boy, that's glorious. If only I could have that kind of power.
Okay, Jack, you were talking about the husband being the first to submit. Could you go into that a little bit more, explain it for us?
Yeah, that sounds strange, since we've been arguing that the wife is to submit to the husband. It seems to me that there are different kinds of issues that we face in a marriage. In fact, we could probably enumerate four. Some things are obviously immoral. So if a husband comes to the wife and says, look, I've been thinking about robbing a bank to solve our financial situation, and I want you to help us out and drive the getaway car or something like that. It's just flat out wrong to rob banks and steal from people. The wife should know that, and her relationship with her husband does not in the least require her to disobey her God. So in a case where the husband would be asking her to do something clearly immoral, she's under no obligation to submit to that. And I don't think headship has anything to say to that situation.
So headship only has something to say to moral issues, not to legal issues.
Well, that I think that's true. However, I was speaking at the level of morality. My point being, headship really only comes to play when you have a clear-cut situation. I'm sorry, when you do not have a clear-cut situation about what it would mean to obey God in the situation. Headship only comes to play there when it ought to be obvious to any halfway wise human being that to do that would be to disobey God. Then the husband has absolutely no authority and no right to ask the wife to do it. That was actually the point I was making. There's a second category that I won't dwell on, but where it's obviously the husband is asking me as a wife to do something that's morally required of me. Well, then obviously it's not even a matter of submission. It's just I ought to be doing that anyway. I ought to be, whether my husband asks me to do what I morally ought to do, then I ought to be doing that anyway.
For example, I am supposed to be raising the kids and loving them.
Yeah.
That's not submission. That's just my responsibility.
Oh, yeah, your obedience to God. Yeah. A third category would be things that really have no significant moral component to them at all. And there's much in life that I would put in that category. Shall we put this picture on the living room wall, or should we put this other picture on the living room wall? And assuming that they're morally neutral, you know, there's nothing about the pictures
they're
that would make
flowers.
Them morally questionable. Yeah, they're both flowers. It is not unusual to find people thinking that headship is relevant there. I'm the husband, I'm the head, I want that picture, so that's the picture we're going to have. It seems to me that's exactly backwards. If my wife wants the other picture, then as the head of the home, I ought to be the first to say, oh, well then, let's have that picture by all means. Let's have the picture that you want up there. Because this is not a matter of conscience. This is not a big deal. And we ought to be mutually submitting to one another in matters where conscience does not come to play. The rule of the day ought to be that I am eager to submit to you as my wife, and you are eager to submit to me as my husband in all matters of that nature. But as the head, I first and foremost should be quick to submit. And that's what I meant when I say I should be the first to submit, speaking with respect to matters that are not matters of conscience. They are morally neutral issues. Mm. And then there's the fourth category, and that's the one where headship becomes relevant, where you have two aspects to it. You have a moral component to it, where hopefully my wife and I would agree, but you also have this other component of a judgment of fact, where we don't see eye to eye, we disagree. And that leads to a conflict in our conscience. And that's where headship, and only the only place where I think headship would become relevant.
So headship has quite a limited scope.
I think so.
Submission has quite a broad scope.
Right.
The picture that I see you forming is a really beautiful one to me. I hear you talking about a man who is growing up and a woman who is growing up. The man, instead of pulling a 10-God act, perhaps a cruel or selfish dominion over his wife, is instead deciding to be a loving person, is deciding to be the first to give, the first to do what's most difficult, perhaps to forgive, perhaps to give in to what he prefers, perhaps the picture on the wall, he really does like picture A, but his wife really loves picture B. It's not a moral issue, and he's, out of his generosity, out of his desire to be compassionate, to give, to love, is saying, okay, that's good, I'll go with that. And that needs to be his continual approach to his wife. And I can see in that approach a softening of the wife, a wife wanting to give to and in return submit to her husband, who is obviously giving of himself in ways that are very often difficult for him.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly the picture that I have. And I probably should point out, that's an ideal, an idealistic picture, because I violate that many, many times. I'm a sinner who wants my way, and to the extent that those sinful impulses come in there, they take me in a direction the opposite of what is right for me to do, and the opposite of what would be the right way to conduct myself in relationship to my wife. But the very least I can do is to hold that out there as an ideal, to keep criticizing me, to keep critiquing me, and calling me into to account for my selfishness and my evil self-centeredness.
Jack, in those situations, when you go your own way, when you're selfish, what is your wife's role?
Well, I think it's important for her to be merciful to begin with. That is, she needs to recognize that she has those tendencies as well. She's capable of being selfish. And just as she would want to be forgiven by God and by me for her selfishness, she needs to extend that same mercy to me. In a way that I will allow, she needs to rebuke me if necessary, you know, to remind me of my responsibility, of my as a person before God, remind me of what it means to be a loving and gracious human being. It takes wisdom to know the timing. Coming along right at the height of my flaming self-centeredness and to get in my face about it is probably not the most constructive, because I'm not ready to hear yet. So she may need to wait for the time when I've begun to come to terms with it myself, and then remind me. And I hopefully will be receptive to that. I mean, if I'm committed to this as an ideal, her rebuke will be kind words to me.
And that does not violate the concept of headship the concept of submission.
Not at all. In fact, as I envision the marriage relationship, it is first and foremost an equal partnership. And we have to begin by understanding that. If we don't understand that, then we have no business going on to talk about headship. It is first and foremost a partnership of two people who are equal with one another before God and equal with one another in one another's eyes, are truly equal partners. Once we've got that settled, then we can ask, okay, what's the structure of responsibility and accountability in this relationship? And then that's where headship becomes relevant, when it becomes relevant at all. But we are first and foremost these partners. And we are to help one another grow. We are to help one another advance in our sanctification and becoming more and more godlike and more committed to the values of the kingdom of God. And it's remiss on the part of a wife if she doesn't play that role in my life, just as it is being remiss on the part of a husband to not play that role in his wife's life.
So what we're saying is that the commonly understood definition of submission, that it's really a less than position, and that headship is a more than position, is very, very much incorrect.
Right.
We are equal human beings before God, and we each have the responsibility to give, to love, to care about another person.
Right. I'm not sure I altogether understand why we have as much trouble with that as we do. We're so inclined to think that if the husband is the head and the wife is to submit to that headship, that makes her inferior. Well, I mean, it makes her inferior in accountability. You know, it makes her inferior in responsibility. I defined headship as having a greater accountability to God, a greater responsibility. But just because someone has an inferior accountability doesn't make them an inferior being or an inferior person. I would illustrate that by when my daughter comes home from school with a math assignment. She asks me to help her. Why would I consider playing the role of the helper? I know math better than she does. I'm much more capable than she is. But yet, I don't hesitate to consider myself the helper. Why am I the helper? Because it's not my assignment, it's her assignment. The teacher didn't ask me to do this problem set. The teacher asked my daughter to do the problem set. She's the one that's accountable to the teacher to get this problem set done. When she comes and asks for my help, she's not saying, you know, I'm really better than you at this, but I need somebody to do the dirty work part of the problem set here for me. What she's saying is, you have more experience here. You have more wisdom here. You know more than I do, and I'm having trouble here. Can you help me? Because I have a responsibility to fulfill, and I'm not sure I can do it on my own. I need your help. That's the sense in which the woman is the helper in a relationship. In some respects, she's going to be wiser than the husband. In some respects, she's going to have more and more relevant experience than the husband with respect to decisions the husband has to make. Calling her the helper doesn't mean she's inferior in her wisdom or experience, and certainly not in her dignity or her being. She's not inferior at all. She's just different, a different person. But it's not she who has the primary and first responsibility before God for this relationship, according to the structure that the Bible says the relationship has. It's the husband. He has the task of making sure this relationship stays healthy. So how would the wife interact with that? By helping him discharge his responsibility to God. And that can involve anything from rebuking him, teaching him, doing things for him, sharing her wisdom, persuading him where he needs to be persuaded. The whole gamut of things that human beings do for one another, that's what a wife needs to do for her husband.
So even if we really turn this on its head, a helper could then be a leader sometimes.
Absolutely, sure. I mean, a lot of people have pointed out that the same word that's used to describe Eve as the helper of Adam is a word that's used to describe God as the helper of Israel. Hmm. Well, God is hardly inferior to Israel. The reason he's described as the helper to Israel is because when they've got themselves in the fix and they're about to be slaughtered by the Philistines, that's not God's problem, that's Israel's problem. He needs to help them with their problem. Well, the wife is the helper in the sense that the problems and challenges, the accountability, the responsibility for their life together has been placed on the man's shoulders. So it's his problem, in a sense. But the wife has been given to him as a co-equal partner to help him with that problem.
Okay, Jack, we only have a few minutes left here. And what I'd like to do is go back to something that you were talking about before. And you said there's one large area of our life where headship and submission just really are not relevant. And you gave the example of a picture on the wall, which one we're going to hang. And I said, well, they're both going to be flowers. So it's not a moral issue at all. Can you give me some more examples? Just for people to be able to hang their hat on.
Well, you know, what brand of car are we going to buy? How are we going to furnish our home? How are we going to arrange and organize our kitchen, the utensils in our kitchen? Where are we going to go out to eat tonight? You might have some examples.
Well, what I'm thinking is, as you're talking, is some of those may truly be non-issues. On the other hand, I think we can make anything an issue. Which way we roll up the tube of toothpaste. I remember one time being in a class where a teacher came in, or actually a guest speaker came in, he was a psychologist, and said that people came in with these big issues of how you roll the toothpaste tube, if it should be one way or the other. And on one hand, it's not really a moral issue at all. But on the other hand, the way that they dealt with it made it a moral issue.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps the fact that I have to have the toothpaste rolled in a certain way, and I demand it, and I act in a way that's unbecoming, that's critical, that's demanding, makes it then an issue where I need to look at, am I bucking up against submission here? So it may look like a non-issue. I want this, you want this. But really, it could be the context through which we're having a major power struggle.
Right. Yeah. When it comes to something like rolling up the toothpaste, there's something else at stake there. The toothpaste is just symbolic of something to the people, and the issue is really different. We have to keep in mind that as an evil person, I can clearly take the whole concept of headship and pervert it in any number of ways and use it as a cloak for my evil intentions and my evil attitudes and evil actions. We must never forget that.
And I can do that as a man, or I can do that as a woman.
Right, that's right. But that's not any criticism of the concept of headship. It's me, the person, that's at fault there, not the arrangement of headship that the Bible teaches us about.
Well, certainly it's a reflection of my sinfulness.
Right.
While Jack and Christine take a short break, I would like to talk to you a bit more about Gutenberg College, its faculty, and what makes it unique. First, most Gutenberg teachers are also instructors at McKenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon. Mackenzie's bottom line is that the Bible is true. Francis Schaeffer would have said, the study center staff believes the Bible is true, true. However you say it, that is radically good news. Understanding biblical truth is all about understanding the purpose of one's life, seeing oneself as desperately needing God's grace and mercy, and discovering the wonderful good news of salvation. In the big picture, all Gutenberg and Mackenzie classes, seminars, conferences, counseling sessions, tapes, books, and articles are focused on knowing and applying God's Word to our everyday lives. If you would like more information, stay with us. At the end of the program, I will give you a phone number and address. However, right now, we need to get back to Jack and Christine as they continue today's discussion.
I think at the heart of what we were trying to communicate in our conversation today is that there really are two different concepts of headship that we have to come to terms with. One is very, very wrong, and one, I think, can be a very, very beautiful arrangement if we understand it correctly. What's very, very wrong as a conception of headship is the notion that the husband is the God and the master in the relationship. He is the master, his wife is the slave. He is the God and his wife is the worshiper. That's a horrible conception of headship. The idea that he has the authority to impose his will on his wife. He has the authority to ask his wife to be at his beck and call and give him his every whim. That's a perverse picture of headship. I think what the Bible is actually teaching instead is that headship is nothing more and nothing less than a prior responsibility and a greater accountability that the husband has to love his wife, to meet his promise to become one with his wife, and to serve his wife. And then it grants him the authority to follow his conscience as he stands before God in performing that task. It also gives his wife a kind of freedom so that the husband and wife don't come to an impasse because of a conflict in their conscience, in their consciences. It gives the wife the freedom to not follow her conscience in ways that if she were alone, she would not have the freedom to do. But because she has to become one with her husband, it gives her the freedom to allow her husband to go in a direction that she would not in good conscience go in. But in order to stay in the relationship and be one with her husband, she must follow him in a way that she wouldn't otherwise go. That's the beauty of the arrangement of headship, is that it allows for oneness to continue even when two finite human beings come to different conclusions about what the conscience dictates. That's all that headship is, as I understand it, and it's nothing more than that, and it's nothing less than that.
One of the things that I thought was very, very helpful was to include that headship and submission always require dialogue between the man and the woman. And in that dialogue, we learn and grow and are taught and do teach each other and become, through that process, more of a couple, more one together. And we only can do that if we are committed to the belief and to the truth that men and women are equal to one another.
Thank you, Jack and Christine. You've been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon. If you would like a copy of this program, if you would like information about the Study Center or Gutenberg College, let me give you the phone number and the mailing address. You may call 541-485-4801. That's 541-485-4801. Or write to Christianity at Work, 1883 University, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. Again, the phone number is area code 541-485-4801. This program and the other ministries of Mackenzie Study Center are made possible through the generous gifts of Christian people who have come to appreciate the biblical perspective on reality provided by the Study Center staff. Next week, Dr. Jack Crabtree and family therapist Christine Barber will continue their discussion of biblical headship and submission. Be sure to join us then.